From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Hollywood is worried about fakes, and I'm not talking about shallow celebrities. Then Marc Maron recalls how Lynn Shelton pitched Sword of Trust, her improvisational film about selling a Civil War artifact.
She's like, you're going to be a guy who works at a pawn shop, and that's it. And we're going to make a movie. And I'm like, how long is this going to take? She says 2 weeks. I'm like, really? All right, then. All right, I'll do it.
And the singer and pianist who goes by Rye isn't quite as mellow as his music. All that coming up on The Frame. Digital video technology is advancing fast, and that gives Hollywood a lot more creative freedom in storytelling. Like the uncanny resurrection of deceased actor Peter Cushing in Star Wars Rogue One, it's no surprise there are some frightening implications that come with eerily accurate digital simulations or manipulations of real people, and the union that represents actors is raising the alarm for how damaging deepfake video technology can be to its members. Eric Gardner covered this topic for The Hollywood Reporter, where he's a senior editor for law and public policy. And he began explaining how, even though Hollywood has been developing visual effects for years, deepfake technology comes with some unique challenges.
What makes this different is the ability to really use technology to blur the lines between falseness and reality in such a hyper-focused way that people really can't tell the difference. That's what we mean by deepfakes.
These are essentially video versions of Photoshop, and they've been used for political use. There's a famous deepfake video of Nancy Pelosi, one of Hillary Clinton. So how are deepfakes affecting Hollywood right now?
Well, in several ways. One is in a pornographic realm where, you know, on a lot of porn sites, you might see a celebrity doing things that she never did in real life. And this is a concern to, you know, many actresses who see this as a violation of their privacy. We also see deepfake technology being incorporated in to explore the boundaries of filmmaking where, you know, you might see something deceptively edited in such a way that you can't really tell that it actually didn't happen. So you might see a documentary made where deepfakes are used to showcase a point. It has its pluses and minuses, its good features and bad features. A lot of people are concerned these days about the political realm and the pornographic realm, but I think everything needs to be explored.
There is obviously a potentially positive use, and I'm thinking, say, of an actor like Carrie Fisher, who has passed away, and everybody who is a part of the Carrie Fisher team says that if there's a way to bring her back to life, essentially, in the latest Star Wars movie using video technology, that that is okay. But there are also some laws that have been proposed, some in New York, that are trying to get to the darker aspect of deepfake. So what were New York legislators talking about?
Sure. They wanted to make the ability to control one's name, image, and likeness as a property right as opposed to just a privacy right. And they proposed barring things like using a digital replica to create sexually explicit material. They wanted to extend the protection of one's likeness past death. And they wanted to create a registry whereby the heirs of famous people could document their official control over their relatives' name and image. It's a very big and broad law that would really shake up things and give people both the right to stop deepfakes as well as the ability to license everything from deepfakes to holograms.
And what is the industry's perspective on this? And where do people like the leaders of the Screen Actors Guild, where do their allegiances fall?
The Actors Union are extremely in favor of doing such a thing. They are concerned about their members' privacy and their ability to control exploitation. But then there are the studios, broadcasters, journalists, and others who worry that, you know, cracking down on this sort of thing in such a broad way might interfere with free speech.
We're talking with Eric Gardner at The Hollywood Reporter about deepfakes. Somebody you quote in your article, a law professor at Loyola named Jennifer Rothman, and she says that there's a potential problem with the idea of assigning rights of publicity as a property right and that maybe through something like a bankruptcy, that could be an asset that is claimed and that the new owner of that asset could exploit your right of publicity as if it were a transferable asset. Is that theoretical or is that something that could actually happen?
And one of the things that pops up is the potential that, say, a celebrity gets into debt and creditors might look to obtain foreclose on that celebrity's likeness rights. Or in a divorce, a spouse might claim that the likeness rights are community property. And so you get to these sorts of things and you have all these sorts of interesting scenarios happen where someone might not be able to control their own likeness. And while we haven't seen too many disputes about this so far, we have seen a few, actually. The Goldman family, they once tried to foreclose on O.J. Simpson's likeness rights. Had they been successful, they could have blocked him from registering an official account on Twitter. They weren't, but that was before legislators started thinking about ways to distinguish between privacy and publicity. You know, Bing Crosby's ex-wife tried to go to court to get a piece of his publicity rights. So these sorts of issues have been popping up slowly, and I would expect to see more of that, especially upon new legislation.
And I'm going to ask you an almost impossible question, and that is there any way to know whether or not something is real or a deep fake? What are people supposed to do if they're looking at a Facebook video or something else and try to figure out if it's authentic?
You know, one of the issues has been authentication. We have heard a lot about deepfake technology. There's a equal movement to create authenticity technology to spot deepfakes. And I suspect such technology would be really welcomed these days. But for the time being, we're going to see a lot of these sorts of stuff. And cynically, there might be instances where something actually happened and someone will claim that it's a deepfake. This will just blur reality and truth and make it all very difficult for us to appreciate what's really going on.
Eric Gardner is senior editor, law and public policy for The Hollywood Reporter. Eric, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, Marc Maron stars as a pawn shop owner who comes into possession of a Civil War relic in Lynn Shelton's Sword of Trust. Lynn Shelton's latest film, Sword of Trust, deals with addiction, racism, American history, and conspiracy theories, and it's a comedy. Marc Maron plays a pawn shop owner in Birmingham, Alabama, and he's asked to sell an antique sword to some shady individuals, local nutjobs who believe the sword can help prove that the South actually won the Civil War. And as is common in Shelton's films, the actors in Sword of Trust improvise much of their dialogue. When I spoke with Maron and Shelton this morning, we started with their first collaboration when she was hired to direct the last season of his TV series, Maron.
My recollection is that we immediately worked so well together and that I was so easy to direct and that I was completely collaborative with her, and I took all of her notes and insights into my performance directly to heart and honored them. Is that what happened, Lynn?
We had a great time, but yes, no, every time I gave Mark a note, he would immediately push back in a rather defensive manner. I think because he thought I was trying to with him. That is what he told me later. That finally, after the end of that process, he realized maybe I wasn't trying to do that, and that giving him a note wasn't meant as a direct sort of character assassinating critique of his.
Wasn't it, Lynn? I mean, let's be honest about it. You know, I'm doing some work there, and you're sort of like, well, that was interesting. Maybe if you do it my way, as opposed to the, you know, whatever you think you're doing that isn't working, then maybe we can move forward with this.
Yeah, you know, you're right.
If that experience is a first date, I don't see you guys even having a cup of coffee afterward.
Well, you clearly don't have the sort of wherewithal to hang in there then, do you? That to me sounds like a perfect first date. Man, this is difficult. You seem to want something from me and you're annoying. I'm interested.
By the end of the experience, in all seriousness, it seems like there was a certain amount of trust that was established on Mark's part. He can speak for himself. On my part, I was really compelled by what an incredibly raw talent and what a natural actor Mark was. And I felt like there were untapped depths there that I wanted the world to see on screen. I wanted to see on screen myself, and so I knew I wanted to keep working with him. I don't know what I should just let him speak about why he ever wanted to work with me again when I immediately was like, maybe we should do this again.
The process really, I'm sort of that way. I think I'm stubborn and a little belligerent just by nature, but ultimately I know in my heart that I don't know everything about acting. I can't see myself from the outside. But once we developed a sort of rapport and a trust, her intuitions and her instincts about, you know, how scenes should work and what's possible emotionally and in terms of what's going on between characters is very sensitive.
Mark, what was Lynn's first conversation with you about Sword of Trust? What did she have and what did she present to you?
You know, my memory's not great, but the thing was, Lynn and I had been writing a script for almost 3 years, and we're still writing it. And we just kept chipping away at this, and she was getting anxious. She wanted to make a movie. And then one day she just said, all right, so, you know, I have an idea. I have a script. I had you in mind. This is your character. She wanted to work with me in a movie, and I was just sort of like procrastinating. We weren't finishing the script, and I didn't think it would ever happen. And then all of a sudden she's like, you're gonna be a guy who works at a pawn shop, and that's it. And we're going to make a movie. And I'm like, how long is this going to take? Then my manager would call me and be like, I think this Lynn Shelton movie is going to happen. And I'm like, really? And he's like, yeah, they're going to shoot in Alabama. And I'm like, how long is it going to take? And he goes, she says 2 weeks. I'm like, really? All right, then. All right, I'll do it. And then the conversations I was having with Lynn were like, oh, that sounds great, Lynn. Yeah, that's yeah, okay. Yeah, that sounds good, and we'll knock it out. It's going to be great.
We're talking with Lynn Shelton and Mark Maron about the movie Sword of Trust. I want to play a scene that, Mark, is your character Mel trying to authenticate the sword at the center of the story.
And this was surrendered to him by General Sherman.
Sheridan.
It was surrendered to him by a Union general.
Mm-hmm. What
battle are we talking about here?
This battle? Oh, it's Chickamauga.
Chickamauga. I don't think that battle is...
Not familiar with it?
I don't think it happened.
Well, it happened.
Okay.
I assure you, 30,000 men lost their lives that day.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. You probably haven't heard of it because it's buried. Mm-hmm. It's not in history books.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean buried?
It is buried from the history books?
Yeah.
By Deep State.
That's also Jillian Bell and Michaela Watkins in the scene. Lynn, what kind of framework do you give for your actors in a scene like that? How much is scripted? How much of it is we have to get from point A to point B?
This is the first time I've worked with improvisation since Your Sister, Sister, which I shot in 2010. So it was an 8-year gap. And I was itching to do it for a very long time. It's a scary way to work because you're writing half of the script, the dialogue, and you're figuring out the scene on the day. And when you only have 12 days to shoot a movie, it's a little daunting. And when there's 4 to 8 people per scene, it's a little extra daunting because you only have 2 cameras and only so much time. But there's a quality, a lived-in quality that you can't really get any other way, and a freshness because there's a genuine sense of surprise on set. Each actor doesn't know what the other actor is going to say. What I gave them was a 50-page, what I call a scriptment. It's sort of half script, half treatment. So the plot is really tightly structured and we know what has to unfold. But for the most part, they're finding their way through the beats of the scene. They're coming up with it all on their own. And then in the edit room is my editor, Tyler Cook, and I are really the ones, you know, who are writing the final draft. So, yeah, it's quite a... it's a terrifying process because you don't know if you're going to get all the ingredients or all the right ingredients to make a really good dinner when you're in the edit room. But it's also a really exciting and dynamic and... yeah, just exhilarating way to work, because if you've got the correct cast, and that is absolutely essential for a movie like this, it's just amazing what they'll come up with. And then I just have to make sure not to laugh too hard and ruin every take.
Mark, what is it like as an actor? Some actors find that liberating. Some find it terrifying. Some find it both at the same time.
I loved it. I thought it was exciting. It was a little intimidating at first because the other actors were, you know, they're real beasts when it comes to improvising. And I was a little intimidated. But, you know, once I realized what my emotional foundation was in the movie and my character and how that guy would interact, it's very comfortable for me. I certainly wasn't scared of it. And it's very exciting to be that present in something. I mean, I think it's one of the reasons why I got into stand-up originally was that, you know, when I'm on a stand-up stage and I'm doing it, you know, I'm really in it and I'm in life and I'm in the present. I don't know what's going to happen or what my relationship with the audience is going to evolve into in any given performance. And so I got that, you know, on set with this group of actors. You know, there are takes where, you know, there's like whatever's on the cutting room floor of this movie is bona fide hysterical stuff. And also there are, you know, very touching moments that they just happen out of nowhere. And I think you can feel that when you watch the movie. When I watched it, you don't know where the story's going to go. And all the jokes sort of happen organically. And, you know, it's getting big laughs. I can't remember the last time I was in a movie where, you know, it was getting genuine laughter.
Part of the idea of the story is whether or not this sword is authentic and can it be authenticated. But there's a bigger idea about the characters' lives. And I want to play a clip from later in the film, Mark, where your character, Mel, has been asked a question by Cynthia, who's played by Jillian Bell.
What about the girl?
I guess we missed each other and, you know, and she said she was going to cleaned up. She said she was clean. She'd come down here and stay clean and we can do the music down here. And so she comes down here and it's okay for a little while, but then she figures out a way to find the people that get up, and she got up, and I didn't get up. I just watch her go in and out.
It's a scene where you learn the backstory of the main character, but it doesn't feel really scripted, doesn't feel expositional, and it's really serious. So, Lynn and Mark, I want to ask you about that scene and how it came together and what you gave Mark, and Mark, what you gave Lynn.
Go ahead, Lynn.
You know, there's some scenes that were sort of written out and there was dialogue to, you know, you could take it or leave it or whatever. But this scene read, they get to know each other in the back of the van.
Wow.
And it became the heart of the whole movie.
Definitely.
But that being said, going into a movie like this, there's a lot of work put in beforehand on backstory. So it wasn't that, like, Mark opened his mouth and I had no idea what it was going to come out. Like, we had discussed beforehand what that might look like. The specificity, though, of how he actually, how that story unfolds, how the other characters draw it out of him, like, all of that we figured out on the day. They figured out, you know, really, with a little bit of steering here and there from me. But it was really, all the heavy lifting was the actors. And it was, I believe we had something like 9 hours of footage just from that one day, trying to figure out what that scene would be.
A lot of the, somehow or another, you know, in terms of my own experience with, you know, being sober and also my own experience with addiction, it's weird that what's happening for me when I do these roles is that I am able to kind of plant memories into my head that aren't specifically mine, but I can make them mine. And a lot of the story that I manufactured for that monologue comes out of my time that I spent on the Lower East Side of New York in the late 80s, living in a neighborhood that was, you know, primarily a heroin open air market. And, you know, seeing the people that would sort of come down the street every day to buy dope and to sort of be living in that world and getting to know, if only by, you know, just familiarity of seeing them over and over again in the neighborhood and making assumptions about what their lives must be like. So I think a lot of the heart of that monologue was me kind of informing it emotionally with my own struggle with addiction and then picturing, you know, the lives that I would see around me on the Lower East Side in the late 80s. And that's why I kind of planted myself, you know, around that sidewalk cafe thing, which was down the street from me where I lived, like there were these bits and pieces of my my past that sort of became my life for the character.
Lynn Shelton is the director, co-writer, and a featured actor in Sword of Trust. Mark Maron stars in the film as Mel. Lynn and Mark, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, John.
Sword of Trust is in select theaters starting today and expands wider next week. The music you're hearing was composed and performed for the film by Mark Maron. Coming up on The Frame, the singer and pianist Rye isn't quite as subdued as his music. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. And just a reminder, we now have a weekend version of The Frame. You can catch up with the best segments from the week all wrapped up in one tidy one-hour-long package. You could tune in Saturdays at 2 on 89.3 or stream it live at kpcc.org. And it's also in our podcast feed. And now the singer, songwriter, and pianist who goes by Rye makes moody soft pop, as heard on his most recent release titled Spirit. But in real life, he's not as subdued as his music. The Frame's Paul Ratliff put together this segment.
Okay, so in life, I think I'm a really, like, silly dude. I don't know. Like, I'm not hyper serious. I'm not, like, furrowing my brow, walking. You know, like, I like being, like, pretty ridiculous. I'm kind of like a normal guy. Like, I like cars. I like driving fast. I like watching action movies that suck. I live such a weird life for the last 11 years or 10 years. It's been so transient and so much travel that I've become very good at just dropping in with people pretty quick. But that's based around humor and being kind of vulgar and kind of ridiculous and not taking myself too seriously. I mean, this isn't that big of a surprise, but I love 90s hip hop. I love the fun and the joy and the, like, the skill that's in 90s hip-hop, you know, that I don't hear today. I'm not trying to always listen to music that's in the same genre that I write in, you know. I love some really weird music. Like, I really love, my favorite group still in a lot of ways is Autechre. What I loved about Autechre was their willingness to create sounds that really disturb you and make you feel uncomfortable. I couldn't believe they were able to accomplish those sonics with like four synthesizers, you know? And I went full geek on it. I like ended up buying all the same synths that they had and started sequencing synthesizers, and it brought me into that world. The only music I don't like is actually just punk, and I don't like feeling anger. The feeling of actually having my nervous system become activated and feeling like anger down my spine is something I really don't enjoy at all. And that's what I get when I hear certain artists' music, usually in that punk world. It bothers me in a way like I'm not comfortable with. And it's not something I want to challenge myself and listen to more, but just because I'm not comfortable with it. I reject it. Oh, you sound so sad. Yeah. So my new record, Spirit, it's a record that is a response to doing well over 100 concerts last year, being on a lot of planes, being kind of discombobulated, waking up in hotel rooms, not realizing what city I'm in, and only being in that city for 12 hours doing a concert and then on to the next.
That's all we have time for. Thank you so much, Paris. Thank you so much. We love you.
It's not super easy to tour like that. Like, there is a toll that you pay physically and emotionally. And I needed something that was really calming for me to make. Give me your patience. Wanna feel your pain. I just needed to make something that literally was just for me to delve into a really calming time in the studio. It's selfish in a lot of ways to make a record like that, but I feel like you're supposed to be selfish when you make a record and not pander. So it was good for me to make that record.
Give me faith. I'll be a soldier.
Rye's music can be heard on your favorite streaming service, and Rye is spelled R-H-Y-E. And that's it for this week. The Frame is produced by the mighty team of Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, and Julia Paskin, with help this week from Emily Henderson. Our news clerk is Andrea Gutierrez, and our intern is Paul Ratliff. Valentina Rivera is the show's engineer, and our opening theme music is by Taylor McFerrin. I'm John Horn. We're back here on Monday from the Moen Broadcast Center. Have a great weekend.